When God began to create the heavens and the earth was without shape or form. It was dark over the deep sea, and God's wind swept over the waters. God said, "Let there be light." And so light appeared. God saw how good the light was. God separated the light from the darkness. God named the light day and the darkness night.
There was evening, there was morning, the first day.
God said, "Let there be a dome in the middle of the waters to separate the waters from each other." God made the dome and separated the waters under the dome from the waters above the water, from the waters above the dome. And it happened in that way. God named the dome sky.
There was morning, there was evening, and there was morning, the second day.
God said, "Let the water under the sky come together into one place so that the dry land can appear." And that's what happened. God named the dry land earth, and God named the gathered waters seas. God saw how good it was, but said, "Let the earth grow plant life, plants yielding seeds, and fruit trees bearing fruit with seeds inside it, each according to its kind throughout the earth." And that's what happened. The earth produced plant life, plants yielding seeds, each according to its kind, and trees bearing fruit with seeds inside it, each according to its kind. God saw how good it was.
There was evening, there was morning, the third day.
God said, "Let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night. They will mark events, sacred seasons, days and years. They will be lights in the dome of the sky to shine on the earth." And that's what happened. God made the stars into great lights, the larger light to rule over the day and the smaller light to rule over the night. God put them in the dome of the sky to shine on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. God saw how good it was.
There was evening, there was morning, the fourth day.
God said, "Let the water swarm with living things and let birds fly above the earth up in the dome of the sky." God created the sea animals and all of the tiny living things that swarm in the waters, each according to its kind, and all of the winged birds, each according to its kind. God saw how it was. Then God blessed them. "Be fertile and multiply and fill the waters in the sea and let the birds multiply on the earth."
There was evening, there was morning, the fifth day.
God said, "Let the earth produce every kind of living thing, livestock, crawling things, and wildlife." And that's what happened. God made every kind of wildlife, every kind of livestock, and every kind of creature that crawls on the ground. God saw how good it was. Then God said, "Let us make humanity in our image to resemble us so that they may take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, the livestock, all the earth, and all the crawling things on earth."
God created humanity in God's own image. In the divine image, God created them. Male and female, God created them.
God blessed them and said to them, "Be fertile and multiply. Fill the earth and master it. Take charge of the fish of the sea, the birds in the sky, and everything crawling on the ground." Then God said, "I now give to you all the plants on the earth that yield seeds and all the trees whose fruit produces its seeds within it. This will be your food, to all wildlife, to all the birds in the sky, and to everything crawling on the ground, to everything that breathes. I give all the green grasses for food." And that's what happened. God saw everything God had made. It was supremely good.
There was evening, there was morning, the sixth day.
The heavens and the earth and all who live in them were completed. On the sixth day, God completed all the work that God had done. On the seventh day, God rested from all the work that God had done. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, God rested from all the work of creation. This is the account of the heaven and the earth when they were created.
Morning. Thank you, youth, for reading that. I'm good here. Thank you. creation stories abound in ancient civilization. Consider this one from ancient Babylon, the Enuma Elish, which I will read paraphrased by the late Rachel Held Evans in her last book, Inspired. In the beginning, before the heaven and earth were named, there lived two wild and capricious gods, Tiamat, goddess of salt water, and Apsu, god of fresh water. These two gods mingled together to produce many other gods, filling the whole cosmos with clamor and chaos. Nothing was in its right place. When the younger gods grew so noisy that Apsu couldn't sleep, he resolved to kill each one of them. A battle ensued, but instead of quieting the noise, Apsu faltered and was killed by Ea, father of the great Marduk. Enraged, Tiamat advanced on Marduk and his forces, backed by a massive army of demons and monsters, hurricanes and hounds. But Marduk was a valiant warrior, so he challenged his great-great-grandmother to do battle alone with him. The two fought and fought until Marduk captured Tiamat in a net and drove a great wind into her mouth so that she became bloated and slow. Marduk shot an arrow into Tiamat's belly, cutting through her insides and puncturing her heart. Then he split her body into two pieces, flinging half of the corpse into the heavens to hold back the waters behind the firmament, and the other half to the earth to hold back the waters that rage below. From her hollowed eyes flowed the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Then Marduk made the stars and moon and assigned the gods to various duties. He put everything in order, sky, land, plants, and animals. Among the gods, he took the highest place, and from the blood of his enemies, he created humanity to serve as their slaves. Finally, Marduk saw that a great temple was made in his honor, a temple from which he could rule and rest. The story is dark, and it is gruesome and full of death and violence. The ancient creation myth from the Greeks is not much better. In it, the original gods, the Titans, became so afraid of the power of their children that one of them, Cronos, began to swallow his own children. His wife Rhea hid from him the youngest of these, Zeus, and when Zeus was grown, he tricked his father into giving up his sisters and brothers. Together, the siblings wage war on their parents' generation and emerge victorious. These new gods create humankind in their own image, yes, but they willfully withhold gifts that they would rather keep for themselves. One of these gods, Prometheus, had compassion on humanity, but his kindness was repaid with eternal torture. And the rest of the gods unleashed upon humanity all manner of evils: sickness, greed, envy, pain, and the like. The traditional creation story of many indigenous tribes of North America is a lot less violent. In their account, all of civilization comes into being on the back of an enormous turtle. We could spend all morning recounting tales of creation from all over the world, but I will spare you. Instead, today we'll spend some time looking at the creation account we find in the Bible, mostly because it is one of my very favorite stories. The creation account of Genesis 1 and 2 is one of my very favorite stories, not because it gives us a specific scientific fact-by-fact breakdown of exactly the way the creation of the world happened all that long time ago. It doesn't do that at all, and yet there are times that I desperately wish it would. Y'all, I have got questions about dinosaurs and the way that the universe came into being and why, and it is over these questions that my 5-year-old nephew and I have bonded. But Genesis doesn't provide any of these answers. It doesn't need to. It isn't meant to. Genesis 1 is one of my favorites because Genesis 1 is poetry. Moses is the traditionally identified author of the book of Genesis, but in recent scholarship, even that has been called into question. What we do know is that Moses, or whoever it was that wrote these stories down all that long time ago, wasn't around at the world's beginning. Instead, they were writing down stories that they'd heard, growing up around countless campfires over and over and over again. As we read Genesis 1, we can start to recognize the patterns that emerge from the words and the way that they all fit together, even as far removed as Hebrew is, as English is, from its original Hebrew. This is a story engineered for memorization. The story is revealed in repetition, certain phrases coming up again and again. And God said, and that's what happened. God saw how good it was. And the bit that solidifies Genesis 1 is one of my very favorites, the sing-song rhythm of the days. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. Now, I am not here this morning to try and suss out any hard and fact scientific facts that Genesis 1 might provide us with if only we look hard enough. I don't think Genesis 1 gives us much of anything in that regard. I don't know how long the work of the creation of the world took. I don't know how old this earth is. I don't know what length of time is considered a day in this passage. I don't know quite how all the plants and animals and the enormous diversity of life we find on this planet came into being. I don't know, and that is okay. It does, however, create opportunities to spend hours with my nephew huddled over books and YouTube videos trying to gather as much information as we can find. If you want to know what might exist out past Pluto and how it might have got there, go ask my nephew Everett, and he will tell you. Genesis 1 doesn't provide us with all the facts, but it does tell us the truth. It tells us the truth about who God is and how God relates to God's people. There are two significant impressions I'm left with after reading the first chapters of Genesis, of the goodness of creation and of God's power in making it. At the end of each day of creation, God looks around at all that God has done, and God pronounces it good. Genesis doesn't bother to give us any of God's motivation for the creation of the world, but it does tell us what God thought about God's work. All of it, every last one of God's ideas, is good. God has thought everything through, everything in order, nothing before its time. Before there can be plants, there must be light and soil and water. Before animals, there must be plants. Before humankind, there must be food for the humans to eat. And all of this, God then gives to us. All of creation is inherently good because God has declared it to be so. And all this creation is then gifted to us, humanity, for both our use and our care. Think back now to the Babylonian creation story I read a few minutes ago. Creation in that story is a mess. There are wars and wishing for the death of the other gods. In it, Marduk kills his own great-great-grandmother and forms the world with the pieces of her broken body. Marduk coldly sets all of creation in order, sets himself at the top of the hierarchy of the gods, and then, from the blood of his enemies, creates humanity. The God who is revealed to us in the beginning of Genesis relies not on violence to create the world, but rather on God's own inherent goodness. One of the most striking of the phrases we find often in Genesis 1 is the repeated, "And that's what happened." God speaks and creation springs forth, all of it exactly as God intends. God's goodness brought forth in God's tremendous power. When God said elephant, that's what happened. When God said sugar maple, that's what happened. When God said Bobby, that's what happened. When God said Amy, that's what happened. Endless variety from the intersection of God's goodness and God's power. The God that we meet in Genesis is immensely creative. We don't get the whole picture in Genesis, of course. There are a variety of animals, and there are all kinds of plants which bear seeds for future growth, and all of this is very good. But all we have to do is look around us, and we can see what is meant. There are giraffes that look like they are in slow motion when they run. There are lizards that can grow new tails, and mammals that have spines and lay eggs, and blue whales whose aorta is big enough for a grown-up to swim through, and honestly, that just blows my mind. But even more mind-blowing still is that we haven't found all the kinds of things yet. We are still finding the things and learning more about the things in this great, big, and very good creation. For example, trees. A few years ago, a scientist named Suzanne Simard began to take notice of the fact that sometimes trees aren't competing for resources, blocking out each other's sunlight and taking as much water as they can find, but instead, they seem to be doing the exact opposite and actually sharing their food and their resources. She devised an experiment using radioactive isotopes and found that she was right. Trees were in fact sharing their resources, and it turns out that forests are not just made of individual trees, but of actual communities of trees. At first, she wasn't quite sure how all of this sharing was happening. It couldn't possibly just be the dense root system, so she kept digging, literally, until she found her answer. Tiny, white, hairy-looking, thread-like tubes, each of them only about the eighth of a width of the width of an eyelash. And they are everywhere, like 7 miles worth of these tiny tubes in a single pinch of soil. And these threads are a fungus. These fungus show up in fossils that we have of ancient trees, but it's only recently that scientists have figured out how the two are related. It turns out the trees have something the fungus need, and the fungus have something that the trees need. And together, these organisms have formed a symbiotic relationship which has formed our forests for thousands of years. The fungus are able to feed the trees the minerals they need to grow tall and strong. Without the network of this fungus and the minerals that it provides, trees would be unable to grow past the height of most flowers. Trees, on the other hand, can photosynthesize. They turn light and air into food, and in turn, they feed much of the sugar to the fungi, which use it to, as Suzanne puts it, build their bodies, in the same way that each of us uses food to grow. Up to 80% of the sugar that a tree produces will end up in this fungal system. A perfect example of this relationship exists in a study done in the rings of trees. Scientists found in the rings of trees growing beside rivers the remnants of salmon that have been caught by bears, eaten, discarded, and then broken down by these fungi and the minerals extracted and fed into the neighboring trees. Trees and fungi are inextricably linked, and because of this relationship, forests, entire forests, have memories and have behaviors. The trees can send warning signals to their neighbors when presented with a threatening insect or disease. If a tree is dying, it will release its carbon through the fungal network, which has been dubbed the wood wide web, and feed its neighbors. Specifically, the more resilient trees in the forest, which are better equipped to survive into the future, thus prolonging the life of the forest. There is an episode of Radiolab about this, and honestly, I've listened to it probably 3 times because I can't quite wrap my brain around it. What strikes me even more deeply, though, than the memory and intelligence of trees is that the God who formed the universe out of nothing, who carved out rivers and mountains and oceans, who thought to place in those oceans things like blue whales and giant squid, the very same God is also the one who placed enormous redwoods and microscopic fungi into relationship with one another, knowing fully that neither would survive without the other. And this is another thing that we learn about God in the first chapters of Genesis. God is a God of relationships. As scientists study the world around us, we're constantly learning new things about the relationships in our natural world. Cows, for example, seem to have best friends. Elephants will remember the places where members of their herds have died, and on each subsequent migration will stop and touch their trunks to the ground in that place. Whales will grieve the death of their babies. Humanity, too, has been created for relationship, relationship with God and relationship with one another. God doesn't stop at making one person. God provides companionship. Well, in the Babylonian creation myth, humanity is created from the blood of the enemies of Marduk. God places humans in God's creation to work the land and to care for it. These humans have an enormous amount of freedom, but also responsibility. They are gifted every beautiful tree with edible fruit, and they are given the task of naming every living thing. In Genesis 3, we learn that God walked with these humans in the garden that God had made for them. The intimacy of the relationship between God and humanity at the beginning is soon broken, but God longs for this kind of relationship with us, so much so that God will spend the entire rest of human history working to restore it. My teacher in fifth grade was a big believer in memorization, and that year we memorized all the things. I still know much of Luke chapter 2 by heart. She didn't have us memorize Genesis 1, made for memorization though it may be. Instead, she chose another poetic interpretation of the same story. This one written in 1927 by the author, lawyer, and civil rights activist James Weldon Johnson. In it, he perfectly captures the greatness and goodness and creativity of creation. Especially moving, though, is his depiction of the creation of humankind. And I'll leave you this morning with the words of his poem, The Creation. And God stepped out on space and he looked around and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world. And as far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. Then God smiled, and the light broke, and the darkness rolled up on one side, and the light stood shining on the other, and God said, that's good. Then God reached out and took the light in his hands, and God rolled the light around in his hands until he made the sun, and he set that sun ablazing in the heavens. And the light that was left from making the sun, God gathered it up in a shining ball and flung it against the darkness, spangling the night with the moon and the stars. Then down between the darkness and the light, he hurled the world, and God said, that's good. Then God himself stepped down, and the sun was on his right hand, and the moon was on his left. The stars were clustered about his head, and the earth was under his feet. And God walked, and where he trod, his footsteps hollowed the valleys out and bulged the mountains up. Then he stopped and looked and saw that the earth was hot and barren. So God stepped over to the edge of the world and spat out the seven seas. He batted his eyes and the lightnings flashed. He clapped his hands and the thunders rolled and the waters above the earth came down. The cooling waters came down. Then the green grass sprouted and the little red flowers blossomed. The pine tree pointed his finger to the sky and the oak tree spread out his arms. The lakes cuddled down in the hollows of the ground and the rivers ran down to the sea. And God smiled again and a rainbow appeared and curled itself around his shoulder. Then God raised his arm and he waved his hand over the sea and over the land and he said, bring forth, bring forth. And quicker than God could drop his hand, fishes and fowls and beasts and birds swam the rivers and the seas, roamed the forest and the woods, and split the air with their wings. And God said, that's good. Then God walked around and God looked around on all that he had made. He looked at his sun and he looked at his moon and he looked at his little stars. He looked on his world with all its living things and God said, I'm lonely still. Then God sat down on the side of a hill where he could think. By a deep, wide river, he sat down. With his head in his hands, God thought and thought until God thought, I'll make me a man. Up from the bed of the river, God scooped the clay, and by the bank of the river, he kneeled him down. And there, the great God Almighty, who lit the sun and fixed it in the sky, who flung the stars to the farmost corner of the night, who rounded the earth in the middle of his hand. This great God, like a mammy bending over her baby, kneeled down in the dust, toiling over a lump of clay till he shaped it in his image. Then he blew the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Amen. Amen.